So, I mean, we almost got to put all this stuff together. We should have enough once you've got to dig it apart. One of them is not the size or.
Seeing it right now.
They make a difference. A bit because lock that
Well,
too. I think we need put that here. The other thing is when you don't have them and you put the screws in for the hero claw, so you can tip them. It takes a canister, so they put in the screws in another bag. Well, we put it in the we put it in the road case. Obviously, it's a bag, but we put it on the respective road case. That's what I say. Don't do that. Put them in the deal for. That's just what master. Other than do it that way. So they don't know because you don't want anything to get lost. So the best place is to put them in here because you need to cover around it anyway. You're gonna not have the cap on the end. So because if it's in a bag, so anyway, Andy's here.
International Broadcasting Center here with team getting everything ready to go.
Yes, finding screws. So that's the problem is having enough screws
Of the right size
of the right size and length.
in the right hole.
Because they actually mess up the heel coils when they're not the right length.
We need one more.
Are you going to do class today?
Yes, so we're starting here right now.
These guys gave up their pizza to come in here and work for you.
Wow.
Yep. Need one more.
Well, I don't know what it is. It might be over on the other table, which is probably the class stuff first, so.
That's what most people.
So that's. Yeah, why don't you move that in the lab and then you can sit on that side and there, I guess. You want a chair back there.
I can be sitting in the
For the HPPS manual, let's see what size hole it is.
Yeah, that's one way to do it too. Okay.
We got three people online, but I don't know if it's on that computer. So we can look at it after class, I guess. I did get my network couplers. We got to install these too. Network couplers. So we put them in the back so that when you hook in the NASA stuff, we can unhook the power injector. Okay, what are we doing today? Welcome. Thursday, September 15th. And we got to get our probes gone. So maybe after this one, we'll move back into the other lab. And then we'll have more people and more space. Okay. So hopefully, and we'll be, I will be not here next week. So the plan is for the people online, we'll take a break from the class meetings next week. And so no class on Tuesday, but you can listen to this video. I'll be at the North American Hair Workshop if you want to know what that's about. There's a link there. But there's a video here that's been recorded, so you can watch that from when I talked to the South Koreans about their airplane and data processing. So makes up for the class. But I think we covered a lot of that material, and I can't remember exactly what I said, but there's another, I guess this is a PowerPoint, so if I look at it, I can remember airborne data processing. Oh, we talked a lot about different aircrafts and aircraft instrumentation. So there were some pilots and some people that have an aviation background on it. So we talked about the different configurations of different airplanes. So there's a little bit of general information at the beginning. And the PDF is so big that it takes a while to load in. So do that on Tuesday, and then for the two people here, tomorrow I'll give you a little multiple choice exam questions that we'll do, and I'll make something up kind of similar to your quizzes. So I don't know, 50. So look at all the material that we've done on the CDP and everything we talk about today. And I suppose I should be on my video. But I should also share my screen so everybody can see what's on. Okay, I share it. So everybody can see the screen. So yeah, next week watch that recording, and we'll have an exam. And so I guess either bring your laptops or you can use stuff in 422. So and I'll be here to open it up, the exam, give you something to do while I'm gone. And then the lab report draft, the lab reports are due today, so I can have something to look at for when I drive. Remember, we got to have the 2D probe quiz. Andy's going to drive the whole way, so I can look at all the lab reports. Email me them. So you got the 2D probe quiz to complete. And so that you're not bored, I made another quiz today. So the other thing, if you should look at for your lab reports, is an article guide. So I made it with a quiz for that. To do that. So same thing, 5 attempts, due next Thursday. So all this stuff's fair game for the exam. And most of the stuff is Quad Dropper probe and the 2DES or the 2D imaging probes. And okay, where are we here? Uh-oh. I need a new version. Okay, 5-minute break. I gotta go update my webpage so I can get my data. So take a 30-second break. I gotta fix something because I just updated this and it didn't update.
So a lot of students want from the program want to do anyways.
Yeah, a lot of the
discussion with the faculty. It used to be that there were so many people who were trying to learn sex.
A lot of they would work at a guessing job, not at 2 years.
Okay, I'm back. And like magic, website's updated. So what I want to talk about after the quiz was our racks. Go over that real quick for some documentation. So Michael Will helped me out on this because we have the racks here. And one of the safety things on the racks, they want to make sure you don't overload the racks so that they can hold the weight of the materials and the equipment that you put in it. So we have to do a form to calculate the moments because they're bolted to the floor. And they want to make sure that they don't, if you get a 10G impact on the airplane, that the racks will stay bolted to the floor. Okay. So what we have to do is measure the weight and then how high it is to calculate a moment. So do you remember in like physics one, you had these moment arms? Moments? No? No? Jen? Physics? So,
yeah.
Try to forget. Okay, see, that's the problem with your classes nowadays. You forget all these things that were covered in the previous class. It's supposed to at least remember that it was covered and I don't remember it. So you got to remember that you forgot it. Anyway. I just wanted to use this to briefly go over, particularly for people that are new, what we have. We have two racks and left rack, right rack. So which side of the airplane they are on. So this is a left one. And this is new. So I got to send this in. And since we have the racks here, we know how they're all configured. We know the weights of each of the equipment. What's 34 pounds? Yeah, more on, well, this one's 98. So, but the limit is 490. So, you know, in some sense, 134 pounds is not a lot in terms of, we could go four times that and still be within the limit. So you can put, so what would weigh a lot that you might put in these racks? Why would you need to go to 490 pounds? That's the heaviest thing we have. What else do they have on?
Well, I know that UPS is definitely.
So UPS is with batteries, but we got light ones of them. But what else would be heavy? Typically, I'm thinking of big pumps, like the pumps they have for the Whisper. So pumps can get heavy because of the motors in them. So pumps, I think, are the heaviest thing. So if you had lots of them, you'd be in the bottom. And these are from the bottom up. You start, so we got the uninterruptible power supply. So we put that at the bottom. They have the batteries in them. They're kind of heavy. So you, to have the moment arms below, you want all the heavy stuff in the bottom. Hawkeye computer is an old computer. So it's big, massive, computer system. And then we have the spec computer, which is our old HVPS 1A computer. And then we have the HVPS 3A and 3B computers. So on this one, we have four computers on that one rack, all independent, all hooked up to the network. Keyboard tray, KVM switch to switch between them. Then we have our new rack. Monitor. So we got this working. I have that on my video. And so we got the rack monitor here, and then we got the mounted monitor up above. So we got the Hawkeye is working on this one, right? And then the KVM switch with the two HVPS computers and the spec computer, which we're going to use for chats and other stuff to monitor the network, maybe. So we have the Hawkeye, which is kind of a main display because we can only, we didn't get a KVM switch with that monitor. And then on the other one, we have the same uninterruptible power supply, and we can see the data from that. So hopefully we can look at the log files and get that working a little bit, make sure we can get that data eventually. But at least we can see if there's any interruptions in the power. And the idea is that we want to make sure we get good power. So, and then we have an analog to digital board to acquire our voltage signals. The monitor for the M300, and so that's the data system that acquires all the non-spec probe data, and then the A to D board for the King probe, the monitor, and on this one we have 2DS computers. So that's just the overview of what's in the rack. So next time, maybe we'll start talking about our aircraft configuration document that lays out everything. So, any questions about the racks? And everybody online can see what's on them. And I have that in the documents on the NAS drive. So we've updated that. And now both of these are within the limits. I think you go out of limits on, well, depends on how you get the stuff. So we got 13,000. This is, again, it's less than a fourth. This is when you got to do math in your head, right? Divide the 12 or 13. So you're at 25%. So should have no problems with this. So, okay. So I have that. And got PDF files for that. And the lecture I wanted to do today is on another problem for me to fix. Well, let's see if I don't think I can get the PDF one either. Oh, I can do that. Okay, well, I'll fix the that wasn't right. That's the syllabus. I got the wrong wink on that one. Yes. Okay, another 5-minute break. You can chat among yourselves and I will fix that part.
How many packs?
Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6, 7, 8. I mean, you can have, I think, 12.
That was R2.
Well, two, and then two per TAMS.
Yeah, two per.
That's six. Five.
Is it working? Yeah, I think if you go on the NAS drive on the instruments spec, there's the ones there. But it'd be really cool if you downloaded them to each one of these from there, because we have the network on there now. So that way you don't have to go.
They work, but either got erased or something happened. 2DS manuals on the 2DS computer, HBPS manuals on the HBPS computer.
They should be there because no one else worked with them. And now I should be able to get my slides. I'll open the file. Open it. Okay, here we go. It's coming. So, Michael, Nicholas said he charged them all. There's a green light that turns off once they're charged.
Yes. That one finished charging.
So you should measure the voltage. What's the voltage? 4.1 as opposed to 3.8. Well, yeah, check all them. Okay. Well, where is the... Okay, still loading. I guess I need my faster computer here. There we go. Okay, if anybody online, I probably won't be able to see this. So, yeah, well, if we have questions, I'll come back after I go through some of the lecture. Did I get the right one? Hold on a second. Oh. Oh, that's... Yeah, that's... Digital data, that's not the one I downloaded. All right. There we go. All right. I don't know how I opened up the wrong lecture. Yeah, got the right lecture now. Lecture slides. Okay, so if you think we have a lot of stuff on our aircraft racks, this is what the research aircraft that is in South Korea is like. And if you see, let's see, what's familiar on this that is also on the P3. Yeah, they got a WCM. There you go. But that's the 2000 version, not the 3000 version. So that's flying this week on the Citation here in North Dakota. So we have more data if we want to analyze that. They have a crowd a CDP, but that's part of the crowd combination probe. And instead of the spec instruments, they have DMT precipitation VIP. Crowd CIP is crowd imaging probe and precipitation imaging probe. So this is like the HVPS, and this is like the 2DS. So that's the crowd physics part of it. They also have a whole aerosol set of instruments, gas phase instruments, and ice. And it's, they call it, yeah, we call it ice, but it's a rice type of probe. So these names are not necessarily universal. And they also have the main computer system is a M300 data system, just like ours. So we could talk about all of the instruments. This is a King Air, and it's a 350. Considerably smaller than a P3. So they want a smaller drop-zone unit. So they have a drop-zone unit from AVAPS, similar to what's on the P3. So they want to make that smaller so they can fit more things in their airplane. So that's why we need to test them drop-zones and have a nice small unit. So we're going to try to do that for the upcoming overseas project to drop drop-zones out of the Citation. So trying to work on getting permission for that and getting the drop-zone tube installed. And if we can ever get these drop-zones to work, we'll be all set. So just like they do for the P3, they'll have drop-zones on the Citation. And they have drop-zones here because they were interested in them because they also have typhoons. So South Korea, last 2 weeks ago, they hit with a typhoon. So, very calm in the Atlantic, but this year. Any other questions about this? Anything?
I'm trying to think. KR is a 40-foot lens for me.
Yeah, the King Air has only two engines where the P3 has four, so you know it extends out at least another 50% on the wingspan. You know, you have the engines that are close here, right? So I think the P3s, you know, you have this one and then you have another set of engines and then you have the pylons. So but it's the duration of this is more like 4 to 5 hours instead of the 8 to 9. So not as long of flight time. But it can get up higher too. You can sample 30,000 feet.
some of this equipment on the pinger is smaller in size than the same wood.
It's packed in there quite tight. We have lots of room on the P3. That we could put a lot more. So this is what I would consider a very heavily instrumented or utilized airplane, where the P3 is what I would consider kind of lightly utilized in terms of the space, at least in the future, as the space and the power. So could put that. The other one is the other link to the P3 is they got a Bacall CRDS cavity ring down spectrometer. So this is one of the things, if you talk to the Whisper people, they have Bacall instruments in there. So they use the same type of technology of the cavity ring down to get water vapor measurements. So the CRDS makes a water vapor measurement on the on there, but it's not behind a that same type of inlet. It's just measuring gas phase.
Is there a reason that Dr. Cook prefers DMT's instruments?
There's differences between them. You know, it's two companies. Each one has advantages and disadvantages. So, and there's a lot of critical history on this aircraft for that. So, and so anyway, other questions? Okay, they have a King, they have an M300 data acquisition system like we do. So that is also on this one. It acquires all the data, King Air 350. And of course, our ADPA processing processes this. The M300 runs QNX. It's a real-time operating system, which means you can predict how long things take. So that's why you don't have to worry about running multiple probes. However, I was talking to Kirk this week, and he was running into trouble overtaxing the acquisition from the instrument. Because he was acquiring some very fast data with lots of instruments on the citation. So he actually had to turn down, change the clock speed on the M300. We typically ran it at 100 megahertz, but it only needs to be ran at the speed of the fastest acquisition on your system, which is on ours is 25 hertz and the same as on theirs. So I think he fixed it by turning down the clock speed of the M300. So it's how fast it goes in and tries to acquire data. Yeah, he turned it from because he was having it too much. It was trying to do too much. So it would try to sample 100 times a second. And so it would have these cycles that weren't being used because you only acquire data every 25 times a second. So you got 3/4 of what you're trying to acquire and what you're trying to do is not being used. So, however, that would cut down the usage because there's only so much stuff the computer can do in a clock cycle. Mm-hmm. And he was overtaxing that with some very quick acquisitions for some of the guest instruments. On the Korean aircraft, they go through a CAPS card. So they have a special acquisition card that they put in M300. So that's what we did for our CAPS probe, which we took out. So we got a special card that acquires the image acquisition, but but it's all ran through the M300, so it's acquired with the same table, it's the same system. But it wouldn't be able to do stuff like the CPI where you're acquiring the digital camera data. But it's also how they set it up because, you know, spec makes the computers, and it's almost like the acquisition is part of the probe in some sense. It's not really an independent system. So the downside with having all the data systems that we have is time syncing them. And so we have to time sync all these across the network, and that is only so accurate. So if you want a better system, you know, this would be accurate, at least all the individual ones, and we get GPS, so you would have a lot more accurate timing for these instruments. So any questions online, put them in the chat. I got that up here. So it's optimized, but it's a little bit harder to set up because you have to worry about multiple acquisitions of multiple instruments. So what I wanted to talk about is digital data acquisition, particularly serial data, and maybe I'll pull up the oscilloscope when I get back and show you the digital waves to acquire the data with the oscilloscope. It's on the next screen. There's two main types of data, analog data and digital data. So analog data is simple but noisy, and you can acquire it very fast, like 500,000 times a second. So this is normal voltage level type of measurement. So that's what our analog to digital board does. It measures analog data. And our board can do 100 hertz. And then it digitizes it at that acquisition. Most of the time, the instruments basically digitize the data close to the source so that you don't have noise. So most of the time, your computers, your acquisition systems are acquiring some form of digital data. So there's two main types. RS-232, we call it. Sometimes we have 422 data, which is also digital data. And then we also have Ethernet, PCIP, IP network. So typically the digital data is lower speed, less than a megabit per second. On the citation now, on our setup, the fastest we're doing it with the RS-232 or 422 is 230,000 bytes per second. They are up to, I think he's on the citation now, they're four times faster than that. They're almost doing 890, I don't know the multiple. Data. So, and our data acquisitions typically is less than 1.5 megabits, but the M300 can do 1.5 megabits per second is the maximum. Point to point is usually the way it is. Sometimes you do what they call RS-485, which is RS-422, but in a non-point-to-point configuration. So we have that on a citation to acquire data from four pressure transducers all together in like a ring configuration. We also have what we call Ethernet. This is what's used in all of our computer networks. High-speed communications. and it's interconnected. So the big advantage of the internet, so or the Ethernet, TCP, TCP/IP, is we use this to talk to the SPEC probes, for example. So you run it, and the FIPS probe uses this. So the advantage is you send packets just like you do RS-232, but this digital error checking. So if that packet doesn't go through and there's noise on that packet, it will resend it automatically. Where on RS-232, the best that you can do is you can have some checksums. You can see a checksum is, it adds all the data together and gives you a value that you can check and see if there was any noise on the data. And on a citation 2019, we had a lot of not only analog noise, but a lot of digital noise where it would start flipping the bits so that we wouldn't, a value of 15 degrees Celsius suddenly became 85 degrees Celsius because the digital data changed.
What caused
it? Noise. Interference with the, it's basically the power. They fixed it, I hope, with power inverters on the aircraft. This, the grounding of the power inverters weren't right or something. So there was a lot of noise on the grounds on the system. And you just see this as like you look at the data and you get these spikes for no apparent reason. And it's because the data is bad. So that's solved with the internet one.
Could that possibly be a reason why some probes, they fail? Because if something's messing up with the power and the probe reads, oh, it's like 150 degrees outside or something, and it's configured to not work in those conditions, will it, like, it'll shut off? And then you'll need to do something with the probe after the fact.
I don't think they have
like automatic shutoffs, like what happened with the 2DS.
I would think that you have to have several, you know, I would check, you know, several times to get several bad packets so that they would filter that. But it's possible, or something like that, that you could get an incorrect reading. So that's big in like airplanes and stuff where you have to have redundant sensors and stuff. So, and redundant communications and all this stuff. So,
but isn't there a thing like where it goes in, like the probes go into a safe mode?
Maybe on the spec ones.
There was a time when we were flying, 2DS was working great, and then all of a sudden the dial voltage is decreasing. And when we were talking spec, says sometimes if you know there's if the probe tips are too hot or something that's abnormal, the probe will go into a safe mode, and then where you'll have to do something on the ground to bring it back to.
Yeah, it could. I mean, they probably have that in there because they have the software intelligence for that, But if it's a computer, it should have the packet checking on the network should correct that. But it could be a sensor error too. And it could be microchips. It could just be the processing chips get messed up too. All kinds of different things that could happen. So yeah, some glitches. But usually if you reset the power, but it might go like into some safe mode that you can't reset. So, other questions. Hopefully, you heard that Christian was asking about the 2DS and going into a safe mode and what might cause that. So, yes, bad communications, bad data could cause problems. So, Oh, there's one more that we have, I guess, that I didn't list on here, but for completeness. So what do you do if the Ethernet at 100 megabits or even gigabit is not fast enough? What's a faster communication than what's faster digital communication than Ethernet?
Fiber optics.
It's a fiber optics. So that's why the Hawkeye with the CPI, it has the fiber optics. So you can, and that's the way they get the internets. When they do transatlantic cables and stuff for the internet, they do fiber optic cables because they can transfer a whole lot of data through them cables. But you gotta be careful about breaking them. And this is the other reason, if you notice the FIPS, they don't record all their data in the aircraft because they don't have fiber cables out to the probe. So they communicate with it, with the network, but they don't actually dump the raw image data. They keep it on the probe. So that's the other way to do it. If you can't move the data, store it and retrieve it later. So here's an example of some noise. These are similar type of instruments under similar conditions. A pressure transducer, and I put the scales the same from -2 to +2 on the y-axis. This is a voltage from a pressure transducer. And then we have time. And for people that like our minutes and seconds, the top 20 minutes, for the top one, I guess the other, well, that's an hour and 20 minutes, and there's several hours of data on the other one. But you see, even on the ground, you know, the measurements before you take off here are nice and steady. But even on the ground, we have some of these. And then when you take off, you have this additional data. So what can you do about this if you have this in your measurements? So this is high frequency, 25 hertz data. So the biggest thing is just average. So you average out the random noise. If it's random, you know, should have one above, one below. They should average out, and you should be able to average over time and get rid of this noise. The best thing is not to have it there to begin with. And then you complain. So when I see stuff like that, then I go to technicians and I go to people. I'm like, we got to solve this noise issue. And this was a problem between the old Citation and new Citation. We got the new Citation. It had the power inverters that I could never get solved. I'm like, to go from the DC to AC power on the aircraft, you put on the stuff. So anyway, I'm told that all of them were replaced and they're hopefully is better now. Repeat the measurements. And so that's the other thing now. If you do this averaging or make a measurement, what's the best measurement of a value? Is it the mold, which is the value that comes up most often, medium, where you have half above and below, or your regular average or mean values? So they may not always be the same. And sometimes I would use a medium, particularly when you're comparing instruments or stuff. So, a little bit now about the digital representation of the data. So everything comes across as ones and zeros. So when we talk about a baud rate, I'll get into that, but it's voltages going from a high state to a low state. And that switch will, the baud rate is how fast do you look at that data to see if it's switching. So you got ones and zeros. So if I have that number up there, what is the digital value? So can you convert that? Go to a website, convert from the number 69. And then there's a hex value, which is base 16. And then a lot of times you have ASCII text representations. So you represent the first 8 bits, give you 255 or 256 values, 0 to 255. And each one of them values is converted to a character. For that. So it's all ones and zeros. And they use hex a lot of times because that's 2 bytes, 1 byte being 8 bits. So you have hex numbers. And so computers don't rewrite base 10. So we have functions of twos. So we have this, want to send a character like W, okay, as a digital value. So you want to transmit this, and the idea is you're going to transmit 10110111. Okay, so I have the ones here, the zero, the 10, one, so it should be the number up above. So typically you have a 2 voltage levels on the y-axis, a mark and a space, they call it. So this would be flipping from like 0 to 2 volts. So some high voltage range. So if there's any noise, it won't affect that digit, that value. So idle, and then you had a start bit, which is a space. So time is along this axis. And this is the y-axis for your voltage changes. So if you start your start bit, and 1 would be high. And then if you continue with the high, it continues to be 1. And you only go to low once you want a 0. But it's this duration that's your baud rate, how fast you're doing that data. You do all your data, and then you have a stop bit. So and then you have to know if you're going to do least significant bit first or the most significant bit. So least significant bit first means that we're starting here. Okay, which way do you transmit the data? And which way do you store the data? So not all computers store the data with the most significant bit on the high or low side. So the Unix systems and the Windows Linux systems do it opposite. So yeah. So Rhode Indian and Big Indian. So you hear if it's the computers of Rhode Indian or Big Indian, in terms of which way the data is stored to come up with a from the bits, which are individual ones and zeros, two to bites. So this is what's transmitted. But it's really a lot better because if you have a little bit of digital noise on here, you won't notice it because you just have to know if you're high or low. So it's when the noise gets to be so big that you flip from this high state to the low state. So some common settings would be the baud rate of 9600, 8N1, so that means 8 bits, no parity, and one stop bit. Some of them are like 7E1, 7 bits, even parity, and one stop bit. Some of the protocols, 8N1 is kind of the standard, but like on the King Air, the nephorometer was doing a 7E1. You got the speed, which is the 9600 or 115, 200. I mentioned we do 233. They are 400. You just keep doubling the speed. So they are factors of two. Data bits, number of characters in each, number of data bits in each characters. You need 7 of them for ASCII data. Parity, method for detecting errors in transmission. So they do have some error detection, but you can still send the whole data stream wrong. And then you have to detect when you got the end of the bits. The other thing is, how do you measure this? So if you're transmitting data, or I guess you got receive, you have a ground state, so that's the low level. So if you measure voltages, you have to measure between two wires. Usually you use 9-pin connectors, but there's only 3 wires that are important. So there's usually a ground, transmit and receive, because you want to talk both ways. And so typically on one side, you got to hook up the receive to the transmit. So one person has to be talking, the other one has to be listening. If you get them messed up, 2 people can't talk at the same time. Doesn't work. So a lot of times you get the 2s and 3s messed around or switched, and that's what a null modem device in the will do. It switches the 2s and 3s. So if you got it backwards, it's easy to flip it back the other way with a null modem. So the cables sometimes are not made always just right to get that as either a null modem or not.
What are the other pins for?
Nothing.
They just make a 3-pin
connector. A lot of times they do. So when we send it through the aircraft wings and stuff, we just send the 3-pin wires. But typically, you have to hook it up to the 9-pin connector on the computers. So 9 pins have become standard. It's like 9, 15, 25, the standard set of pins. There are other things that people use them for, but not for communication. It's a standard. The difference one is with 422, what you do is you have a ground that's shared between the transmit and receive, and having a common ground can cause problems and limits how much noise you can accept. So on RS-422, what you do is you have a ground for each of the transmit and receive. So you have to have four wires. So you have two grounds. And that makes it easier to transmit the data longer distances. And then in the 422, unlike RS-232, where you always use 2, 3, and 5, some people use 1, 2, 3, and 4, and any other combination of the 9 pins, and any different combinations of everything. There is really no standard. So that's why when you hook up the 422s, you've got a lot of times play around with which one is on which pins. Because it seems everybody does it differently. I shouldn't say there's no standards. Problem is, there's like 20 different standards. So then it's a lot more complicated. Okay, let's see here. We're almost getting done, I think. I start talking here a lot about data acquisition. I'll stop there. So a couple more points, and then you can maybe come back to this. If you're acquiring a data system, it's can be difficult to program and acquire the data because you want to make it universal and acquire it from all the different instruments, which is always a lot harder than if you just have one type of system and you just have to use one type of acquisition. Data acquisition system is kind of universal. And I'm trying to discuss here why a data acquisition is not good for post-processing. So, I don't know. Before I wrote ADPA and other stuff, people would just do all their processing on the M300 itself. Write formula tables, get the data, and write out whatever you want. Calculate everything on the data acquisition system. And the same thing you could do in the probes, like the Ames probe. They actually process the data, come up with atmospheric winds. So how much processing do you do on the data acquisition system as opposed to acquiring the raw data and processing it later? So typically we do some processing on the M300 to display stuff, but that's not used in our post-processing. And I don't even try to compare the two because it'd be an infinite thing. When I was a graduate student, I had a job at NASA Langley, and they had a new computer system that was going to process the SAGE-2 satellite data. They said, well, maybe we should get this new code to match our old code. They spent like over a year trying to get it to match before they finally gave up and said, oh, they're just two different computer systems. Why do we expect them to give us the same answer? They start with the raw data, and then they would get different processed data afterwards. But computers handle data differently. So a lot of times you don't know what's happening in the commercial systems. So that's sometimes what companies will do. They hide stuff in their data system as proprietary information because they've done a lot of work to develop that. And the hardware is easy, but the software is where all the development stuff has gone. Not modular systems, hard to automate. And one of the things you can't do with a data acquisition system is there's no way to use future measurements in your processing. So when I use ADPA, I actually use data in the future to help me process data at that moment. So that's done with the King probe and the outer cloud corrections. So we have algorithms that actually use future data to come up with that measurement at that point. And you can't do that if you're just acquiring data in real time. So it's more about software stuff. Read my ADPA paper. So you can make data, your software, where you can change the data. I've seen this. They're looking at aerosol measurements and a plume downwind of a city. They fly upwind and downwind. Well, because of the way they're processing the data, the downwind measurements were a lot higher. But it was all because of the way they processed the data. And they didn't look at the raw measurements. So you can get that. And a lot of times you should look at source code. So to get accurate results. And then about these ones that reproducibility is not as great as you think it is. You know, it's almost never that we can go back and redo a another exact program. We just keep doing these different field projects. Hopefully we get the same data, but you really have to believe your data and process it correctly. My famous one is NASA had the ozone hole. Andy might know this. They had the satellites in Antarctica for measuring the ozone. And they saw that in their processing code, they put a line in there that said something like, oh, we'll blow 330 or 350 Dobson units, that we just ignore the data. It's never going to be that low. If it is, it's something wrong with our data. And so they had a satellite up there measuring ozone. And then in 86, they went and measured it with balloons. And they found all this low ozone measurements of like 250 Dobson units. And they believed their ozone measurements on their ozone sondes. And so they've said, oh, there's something wrong here. NASA go back and look at their data. Oh, yeah, I guess we saw that 2 years ago. We didn't throw out the low data values.
The British Antarctic survey,
yeah.
Wasn't it the Japanese or the Chinese who then figured it out and then told NASA?
Well, there's a couple different groups that did, I think. So, but yes, they just told NASA. You know, go back and look at your data, and then they process the data because they just had them fragged. So don't frag your data. The other thing is, don't necessarily throw out unrealistic values. So we did this for aerosol absorption measurements. So the absorption is, you know, so you have a particle and you can have negative absorption. So what is negative absorption of a, so you have a particle, you have a light, and it doesn't absorb the light. So you wouldn't get zero, but you'll get a negative value. So what does that physically mean?
It's emitting?
Yeah. So it's emitting light. So how can you have a particle in the atmosphere that's emitting light? It's physically impossible. It would be like a radioactive fluorescent aerosol. Anyway, they don't exist. Physically impossible, right? So if we have absorption measurements, wouldn't we just throw out everything that's negative? What happens when you're in a very clean environment? The measurements are very near zero, and there's a lot of random noise. If you throw out them zeros or the negative ones, you're going to artificially increase your absorption.
Just take the averages.
You take the averages, but you have to average in the negative values because of the way that the sensors work. That this physically, it may not give you a negative value, but the sensors can have negative values. And if you throw them out,
would that just be that the instrument wasn't calibrated correctly?
It's not a calibration. It's the fact that the you get next to the noise floor of the instrument. Yeah, the King has problems because it can get that too. You know, but that's because it's a the King is because it's a difference of two numbers. So if you take a difference, the one should be higher than the others, but they're not always. And so what happens when you take the difference, atmospheric winds are a great example. You're moving at 100 meters per second, and you got a 2 meter per second wind. Well, to get that, you got to take 100 meters, subtract 98 meters, and get 2. You're subtracting two big numbers. What happens when the one is, you know, they get very close to each other and they have noise on each other. So you can subtract that and you get a different value. So that's what happens with the King probe. You subtract two big numbers that should equal zero, but they don't quite equal zero. Okay, let's go. I will stop there. Any questions online? Digital data? I guess we went longer because, well, kind of 2:15, but had all my interruptions. So
I just have
that is my question. Question on digital data that we talked about and looking at with that and the acquisitions for the data. So I don't see any questions on the chat.
I have one general question.
Oh, you have a question. I hear something.
Yeah.
I got to turn up the volume here. Hold on a second.
All right.
What is my volume? My volume is low. Why is my volume low?
I will type.
Hold on. I got to plug in my speakers. Sorry.
Go ahead. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Yeah, it's just a general question. Like, are we, Peter and me, are we required to give an examination next Thursday?
If you want, I can give you the exam. It's a little bit different to get into our system because I was going to use our Blackboard system for it.
All right.
I can give you the quiz if you're honest and you can take it.
Fair enough. Sure. We would like to try.
Okay. I'll make it available. It's just going to be a multiple exam. So I'll probably do it the same way as I've done the quizzes for you guys.
Cool. That works.
I'll just have it. You can only do one attempt and I'll set up that way different. Maybe I'll do your quizzes the same. I don't know. It is be like multiple choice, and it's going to be very similar to the quiz questions and stuff. So,
all right.
Cool. And that. So, yeah, we'll have it open for an hour or something. Send you a link so you can just take it. I'll try to send it out to the email list. And it'd be something where it's not open except for the 2 hours of the cross period or something.
All right, fine. That's open.
So,
thanks so much.
Comments, send me if you want to do your lab stuff, send me that, and I can look at the analysis you did too.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Well, with that, I'll let you guys go and we'll talk like this again in a week from Tuesday, not next week. So watch the video on Tuesday also, or before Tuesday, Does that cover some of the same stuff we've been talking about? Okay, we'll talk to you later.